From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, forensic psychiatrist Dr. Park Dietz. He said his true calling is to study and spend time on the strangest of crimes. He was an expert witness for the prosecution in the murder trials of Jeffrey Dahmer, John Hinckley, and Joel Rifkin. In each case, Dietz presented evidence that the defendant was sane and knew he was committing terrible crimes. Dietz also consults with corporations about how to deal with violent employees and customers. He's the guest expert on the HBO documentary Murder 9-to-5. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Bob Dylan's Greatest Hits, Volume 3. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Federal authorities in Utah are warning university officials to watch for suspicious packages after a mail bombing killed a New Jersey man this weekend. The FBI now says that package was mailed from San Francisco. The latest bombing is believed to be the work of a serial bomber who has struck in Utah before. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
The FBI believes the mail bomb that killed an advertising executive Saturday in New Jersey was sent by the same person responsible for 15 bombings in 16 years. Police call the unidentified attacker the Unabomber. Two of the explosions took place in Utah. Two other mail bombs were sent from Utah. A composite sketch of a suspect was circulated after one of the Utah bombings. The Unabomber's targets include people associated with universities, airlines, and computer companies. Federal officials here say university staffers should report suspicious packages to police and should not open packages with strange return addresses. Investigators posted a $1 million reward for the attacker, believed responsible now for 2 deaths and 23 injuries. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
A University of Michigan study finds more young children are using drugs. Researchers said today that 1 in 4 American school children tries illegal drugs before they get to high school. The report says 25% of 8th graders admitted to using drugs at some point. When marijuana and other inhaled drugs were included, the figure rose to 35%. Vice President Al Gore goes to Russia tomorrow for a diplomatic visit. Russia and the U.S. have been at odds recently over plans to extend NATO membership to former Warsaw Pact countries. White House spokeswoman Dee Dee Myers agreed there's some tension, but she said relations are still strong.
We've made a lot of progress in the last 2 years through the president's policy of engagement, including on security issues. There are no longer Russian nuclear weapons targeted at the United States and no longer American weapons targeted at the Russian people. We've made tremendous progress on nonproliferation, including the recent accession by Ukraine to the NPT, allowing for the implementation of START 1.
Meanwhile, Republican Senator Mitch McConnell is calling for a change in U.S. foreign aid policy. McConnell will head a subcommittee that oversees international spending. He said his approach will focus on 3 basic goals.
First, foreign aid must protect American security. Second, foreign aid must promote American economic interests. And third, foreign aid must preserve political and regional stability.
Kentucky Republican Mitch McConnell. IBM has stopped shipping personal computers built with Intel Corporation's Pentium chip. IBM says there are more problems with the chip than the company first believed. Customers have complained the Pentium makes mistakes in some mathematical operations. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 22.88 at 3713.99. This is NPR. The Supreme Court today let stand a lawsuit from the National Association for Women and other groups allowing federal anti-racketeering laws to be used against abortion protesters. Anti-abortion groups had appealed to the High Court, saying the racketeering laws don't apply to their demonstrations. At issue is part of the law that bars using violence or threats of violence to obtain property. The abortion opponents say their protests outside clinics do not violate that provision. Japanese and Philippine officials launched an investigation today of the mid-air explosion aboard a Philippine airliner over the weekend. The blast left 1 person dead and 6 injured. From Tokyo, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
There are reports today that investigators are considering sabotage as a possible cause of the explosion. The blast that blew a 2-foot hole in the floor of the Philippine Airlines jetliner was initially claimed to be the work of a Muslim separatist group in the southern Philippines. But suspicions have arisen about that claim made by an anonymous caller yesterday. The group's leader denied responsibility today, and the chief of police at Manila's airport questioned their involvement. PAL Flight 434 was on its way from Manila to Tokyo via Cebu, with 293 people on board when the explosion ripped through the cabin. A 26-year-old Japanese engineer was killed. Earlier reports cited smuggled fireworks on board as the culprit, but Japanese officials say a bomb attack has not been ruled out. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta says President Clinton is still studying a possible middle-class tax cut. But speaking on CBS today, Panetta said the president is firmly against any reduction that would add to the budget deficit. Mr. Clinton is focusing on the budget all day today. Panetta said cuts in Social Security benefits are still out of the question, despite that recommendation from a bipartisan commission. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 1 in 6 violent crimes occurs in the workplace. Workplace violence is the subject of a new HBO documentary called Murder 9 to 5. The program's guest expert is forensic psychiatrist Dr. Park Dietz. His company, Threat Assessment Group, in Newport Beach, California, advises businesses how to deal with dangerous employees and consumers. Dietz is often called on to serve as an expert witness in criminal cases. He testified in the trials of Jeffrey Dahmer, John Hinckley, and Joel Rifkin. He's also the forensic psychiatrist for the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime. Dietz says the role of a forensic psychiatrist is different from that of the clinical psychiatrist. A clinical psychiatrist tries to help the patient. A forensic psychiatrist is more like a detective who examines all the evidence to try to find the truth. I asked Dr. Dietz first about workplace violence. Are there signs that an employee may turn violent?
There's always a risk in talking about warning signs that people will think it means someone's about to go berserk, and no warning sign tells us that. Until the man shows up in camouflage with multiple weapons, you don't know for sure it's going to happen. What people can spot and do something about, however, is employees who are making other people uncomfortable and who are themselves uncomfortable or overwhelmed. Now, that's not a warning of violence. That's a warning of a person with a problem. And all of this begins with troubled employees in need of assistance. So we think the most important thing is spotting people who are depressed, people who are too anxious to function, people who are suspicious of their coworkers, people who are socially withdrawn and never interact with others. Those are all signs of run-of-the-mill mental disorders that are very common. They're all treatable. And today, it's particularly tragic when people have a common disorder like depression, afflicting 10% of Americans, for which treatment's readily available, and they're not getting it because no one takes them by the hand and says, look, you're obviously not feeling well, and I know somebody who can help with this.
In the HBO special Murder 9 to 5 about murder in the workplace, you interview Richard Farley, who killed 7 and wounded 4 employees at the corporation where he worked after he was fired 2 years before. Tell us a little bit more about his crime.
Richard Farley had taken an immediate interest in a coworker, Laura Black, a young engineer, and had pursued her in inappropriate ways from the time they met. He'd only been at that facility 2 weeks when they met, and at that point, the right thing to do would have been to intervene and make sure that she and he were no longer working at that facility. And it was apparent from the outset. What he did was to follow her everywhere, obtain wax impressions of her keys, break into her personnel file, and even the papers regarding her security clearance, and made her life miserable through his pursuit of her. He's a classic example of what really deserves the term stalker, though that term's much overused these days. And for 2 years, he did this to her in the workplace before the company finally got rid of him. They had resisted firing him because he threatened to kill the human resources manager when he was counseled about this behavior. They made some ineffective efforts to get him into treatment, and it was treatment of a kind that wasn't going to work for him anyway. And 2 years after he was fired, having continued to stalk her for those 2 years, he then entered with multiple weapons, 98 pounds to be precise, of weapons and ammunition, and he killed people and shot computers and equipment as he went through the facility. By the time the smoke had cleared, there were 7 dead and others wounded, including Laura.
She was wounded?
She was shot in the shoulder, and it took several reconstructive operations for her to be able to get up and about. She's well recovered now.
I want to play an excerpt of the interview you did with Richard Farley, the murderer. He's in prison now?
Yes, he's awaiting execution on death row at San Quentin.
And was this interview conducted expressly for the HBO program?
Yes, it was. And it was the first interview he'd given.
What do you think that Laura Black could have done to prevent the shooting?
Treated me a lot differently than she did.
You mean go out with you?
Go out with me, yeah. Yep. That would have worked.
But she didn't want to go out with you.
I agree. She didn't want to.
There came a time that you thought of killing yourself in front of Laura.
Yes.
Did you think of taking her with you?
I don't believe I ever thought of that. I mean, my intention was not to hurt Laura in a physical manner. Psychologically traumatize her, make her live with the experience of having my blood and guts all over her is one thing, but to physically hurt her, that I never intended to do that.
Hearing Richard Farley say what he did about how, well, she should have treated me better, she should have gone out with me, is there anything that Laura could have done to prevent what happened?
There's nothing Laura could have done to stay in that job and prevent this tragedy. Nor was it her responsibility to prevent this tragedy. It was the company's responsibility once they learned that they had such an inappropriate, harassing, threatening employee and later former employee. Now, there are things that women in that situation can do to protect themselves, but some of them require great sacrifices that people aren't prepared to make. The same is true for women who are being pursued by former lovers instead of strangers or coworkers, as was the case here. For them to be truly safe from men who mean them harm requires that they make radical changes. And all too often, the only perfect solution requires that one of the parties be far away from the other and that there be no possibility of their encountering each other. If we can't put the men in prisons or hospitals, where many of them truly belong, it unfortunately becomes necessary for some women to relocate and change identity, which is a very radical, difficult step.
I know you say the company should have interceded, and there's really nothing Laura as an individual could have done to prevent this. On the other hand, the human resources director, you said, was being threatened with his life. What can a company do to protect itself if it fires somebody who's already threatened murder?
Well, most threateners are not as dangerous as Richard Farley. Where they're focused on an individual and pursuing them persistently, it adds many special wrinkles to the scenario. But the average employee making death threats can be managed out of a company quite successfully. We handle 150 of those a year in our office, and so far without incident. The most important principles are reflect the awareness that the reason people become violent is that they feel desperate, feel that they don't have other options, feel justified in this kind of behavior, and have little to look forward to. So we like to design scenarios in which everyone is a winner and the employee gets to look forward to other opportunities in life, though they're not going to be at this company in light of the bridges that they've already burned.
You feel like if a company is respectful toward the person who is threatening somebody in the company, that that person is less likely to blow their top?
Well, ideally, companies learn to be respectful to everyone well before any threats have been made. It's lack of respect that underlies many of the worst tragedies. Joseph Westbecker, who committed a mass murder at the Standard Gravure plant in Louisville, Kentucky, had been teased not only by his coworkers, but even by his supervisor, with the nickname Rocky after he lost a fistfight with a woman. It's that kind of teasing that leaves people feeling humiliated that makes it very difficult to deal reasonably with individuals. A man who has endured teasing and that form of harassment is going to develop resentment toward the people that have done it to him. And that resentment underlies many of the worst cases.
My guest is forensic psychiatrist Dr. Park Dietz. He appears on the HBO documentary Murder 9 to 5 about murder in the workplace. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Park Dietz, a forensic psychiatrist. He's the forensic psychiatrist for the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime. He's also consulted to the CIA and has served as an expert witness in the trials of Jeffrey Dahmer and John Hinckley. These are some of the tools he uses as a forensic psychiatrist.
The most important tool really is analytic thinking. The second most important is one's skill at finding information that may not be right on the surface, whether that means going to a crime scene and noticing something no one else has noticed, or doing an interview that asks the right questions, or rifling through boxes of physical evidence to notice the thing that was missed. All of those can be very productive in my field. In the John Hinckley case, when John Monahan and I went through the evidence room, we found in the bottom of a Band-Aid can a ransom note for a skyjacking that Hinckley had created. And by virtue of the fact that we read all the books he had read, we found where he'd plagiarized that skyjack note from. It was a book called The Fox is Crazy Too. Armed with that information, it was possible in examining Hinckley to ask him what was the note for. And he indicated that he was considering skyjacking a plane in order to get the attention of Jodie Foster. Well, we wouldn't have known that if we hadn't looked through the Band-Aid can.
Is that how you found out that that he wanted to shoot President Reagan to get her attention also?
No, that was pretty obvious. He gave a lot of evidence that he was interested in impressing Jody with that act. But it's the other crimes that he contemplated that we wouldn't have learned about if we hadn't done our homework.
Mm-hmm. A lot of your work has dealt with evaluating whether a killer was criminally insane. I think it's always hard for lay people like me to understand the law's definition of sane and insane. For instance, with someone like Jeffrey Dahmer, and you were an expert witness on his case, it's hard to fathom how a serial killer who ate parts of his victims could possibly be sane in the way that I think of sanity.
Sure. Sane and insane are quite unfortunate old legal terms. If one changes those terms to responsible and not responsible, it all makes a lot more sense. There are a lot of individuals who are quite sick, mentally ill, but who are nonetheless responsible because the nature of their mental illness was such that it didn't affect those particular mental functions that the law looks at in measuring responsibility. So, for example, even many of the people who are raving lunatics by any ordinary understanding of that concept will nonetheless know that it's wrong to steal a car, for example. And if they steal a car, they do it knowing that it's against the law, that they could get caught, that this is a wrong thing, and they could also have gotten where they want to go without stealing the car. Now, that's all the law requires, really, to hold them responsible for stealing the car. They have to know it's wrong, and they have to have the ability to choose some other way to behave.
Now, you argued that Jeffrey Dahmer was sane when he committed his crimes. What evidence did you come across that helped you reach that determination?
Actually, I didn't argue that. Early in my career, I made the mistake of arguing, and now I just present evidence to the jury and let the lawyers do the arguing.
Mm-hmm.
But the evidence that Dahmer was responsible was pretty overwhelming. All the experts who examined him agreed that he was responsible with respect to whether he knew right from wrong and whether he knew these acts were wrong. There was no disagreement there. The sole disagreement was whether he could control himself. And the defense argument was that he could not control himself because his perversions made him want to do this so badly that it was a compulsion. The government's argument was that even though he had perversions that made him want to do these things, he had the same ability to control his behavior as anyone else does. And the kind of analogy that I made before the jury was that the fact that Mr. Dahmer used a condom before each of his sexual interludes with his victims indicated that his ability to restrain his impulses was somewhat greater than the average teenager in the back seat with his girlfriend.
No, was the fact that he used a condom evidence that had already been discovered? Or is that something you had to find out about?
I think I'm the only one who asked. And that's an example of how asking the right questions matters.
Why did you ask? Why did you think of asking?
Because when I'm doing my job well, I am able to put myself in the place of the offender and to imagine what that's like for that offender. What are they thinking about? What are their choices? What are they seeing?
Now let's get back to Jeffrey Dahmer. You said you realized you should ask whether he used condoms. Who did you ask?
I asked him. I spent 3 days examining him on videotape as part of my preparation, and he was very forthcoming. He and I even sat together and watched the videos that had been seized from his home, both pornographic videos and the things that he thought were important, which most people don't think of as pornography, like The Exorcist III or Return of the Jedi, but for him they had sexy scenes in which people used power to control others.
So he got turned on by scenes? What scenes?
In Return of the Jedi, it was a scene in which the head bad guy causes the Luke Skywalker to writhe on the ground in pain using some kind of magical ray. And Dahmer thought that was a great scene. He used to have his victims watch that with him before he drugged them.
Now, was he surprised that you didn't think this scene was a real turn-on? Did he think that other people shared his sexual tastes?
No, not of course not. He knew that he was quite out of place with his tastes. The man was not at all out of touch with reality, but he had very peculiar tastes and, unfortunately, very limited ability to meet his needs in legitimate ways. Another man with the same perversions could well have found a partner who had the same interests, which were to lie next to each other and fondle and be gentle and not do the painful things that some male lovers do with each other. He was actually a far more gentle man than people can appreciate. His death saddens me.
Were you surprised that he died? That he was killed in prison?
I was surprised that he was back in population so quickly. Last I'd heard, he was in protective custody, which was appropriate. And apparently for close to a year, he's been in population. So it was inevitable. He got two kinds of bad press that made this inevitable. One was about what he actually did, and of course that's tragic and horrible and everyone would agree. But there were two false impressions given of him. One was that he was a bloodthirsty cannibal, and the other was that he was a racist doing this to people of color. And neither of those is true. With respect to his being a racist, in fact, he was an equal opportunity killer. He selected these victims because he found them attractive. This was his seduction, his courtship. Now, what he did to them, obviously, is horrible. But most of the acts that have entered popular lore were things he did by way of disposing of evidence. He mutilated the bodies merely for the expedient purpose of getting them out of his apartment in a manner that no one would be able to trace to him. and he had a fairly elaborate system, almost a factory for disposing of human remains with vats of acid and storage bins. The reason there were so many parts of bodies left at the time he was caught is that he'd fallen behind. He had killed more people than he had the means to dispose of, and so it was a production line deficit. Yeah. But if he'd had his way, that evidence would not have been there.
Getting back to everybody's question, how can somebody who is eating some of the remains of his victims be sane? Are there questions you asked Jeffrey Dahmer about cannibalism to test his responsibility?
Well, of course, he was not charged with cannibalism. He was charged with the homicide. Mm-hmm. So the only moments that mattered with respect to his responsibility were the moments during which he killed his victims. At those moments, he was always intoxicated because he found the killing repulsive, and he had to get himself drunk to kill the unconscious victims whom he feared would wake up and get him in trouble. So he was killing them in order to be able to keep them around a little while longer and evade arrest for what he'd already done by drugging them and using them while they were unconscious. The cannibalism obviously was of considerable interest. We don't get to examine many people who've done that, but the extent of what he had done was far less than one might imagine. He had, in fact, filleted some muscle tissue, which he'd kept in the refrigerator, and he had consumed small portions of muscles from a few of the victims that he found most attractive. The meaning of that to him by that stage was largely related to his finding those men the most attractive to him, wishing that they didn't have to die, in order for him to fulfill himself, longing to have them still around as living partners, and feeling somehow this would make them a part of him and make their death less of a waste. Now, that's a kind of primitive idea. It's very related to rituals in many societies, including our own ritual of Holy Communion, in which the theory is that one takes into oneself the flesh of another by consuming it in this way, and therefore that person becomes part of oneself.
So what was the most educational aspect for you about hearing him describe his reasons for cannibalizing some of his victims? Since, as you said, it's rare to be able to talk to somebody who's done that.
Well, you see, I went into all the details with him. I asked him how he prepared it and whether he did anything to make it a romantic occasion, since he'd implied that this was somehow connected to his sexual interests. I asked him if he had candlelight or wine or anything special, and the answer to that was no. But he did look at photographs of the victims while they were alive, while he would consume part of them, and he came to find that somewhat sexy. He was experimenting on the fringe. Now, I predicted 15 years ago that when the culture ran out of ways to play with sadomasochistic sexuality, the last frontier would be erotic cannibalism. And there have been a number of elements of the popular culture that have promoted that idea, from the covers of certain rock and roll albums to some experimental theater that's played with the idea to the great attention given to Dahmer's crimes. But there really isn't much else. I mean, there are now specialized magazines for necrophiles, and there's an enormous amount of material for people involved in sadomasochism and bondage. And erotic cannibalism is the last frontier of the perverse.
Dr. Park Dietz is a forensic psychiatrist. You can see him on the HBO documentary Murder 9-5 about murder in the workplace. It will be shown several times over the next few weeks. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Dr. Dietz will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, pathologies, perversions, and the influence of movies on the sick mind. We continue our conversation with forensic psychiatrist Dr. Park Dietz. He was an expert witness in the trials of Jeffrey Dahmer, John Hinckley, and Joel Rifkin. Dietz was a consultant for the HBO special Murder 9-5 about murder in the workplace. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Bob Dylan's third album of greatest hits. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The FBI says a package bomb, which killed a New Jersey advertising executive this weekend, was mailed from San Francisco. The attack is the latest in a series of mail bombs stretching back to 1978. Authorities believe one man is behind the attacks, and they're urging anyone with information to come forward. Steve Inskeep of member station WBGO reports from Newark.
Investigators say some of the 15 bombs arrived through the mail, but others were hand-delivered, and one exploded on a plane. What the attacks have in common is a man who's been spotted only once, wearing dark glasses and a hooded sweatshirt, who has written to newspapers bragging of his exploits, and who reportedly has marked the initials FC on each of his packages. Postal Inspector Jay Skidmore says the Unabomber has confounded investigators since the first attack in 1978.
It has taken a long period of time because the person is good. I mean, I make no two words about that. He's good at what he does, unfortunately.
Most of the attacks have targeted professionals, and officials are warning people in some of those affected groups to beware. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep in Newark, New Jersey.
The Tennessee Valley Authority will leave unfinished three nuclear reactors currently under construction. TVA Chairman Craven Crowell said today the authority needs to move beyond what he called outdated policies that have put the agency deeply in debt. A grand jury in South Carolina has indicted Susan Smith on charges of killing her two young sons. Smith has confessed to drowning the boys. Prosecutors will decide next month whether to seek the death penalty. A Kentucky jury has found drug maker Eli Lilly and Company not liable in the so-called Prozac trial. Brian Corin of member station WFPL reports from Louisville.
Jurors reached their verdict in the first full day of deliberations after getting the case on Friday. The verdict was in connection with a lawsuit that accused Lilly of masking dangerous side effects of its popular antidepressant Prozac. Survivors and victims of a 1989 shooting spree in a Louisville printing plant contended that Prozac caused Joseph Westbecker to turn homicidal about a month after he started taking the drug. On September 14, 1989, Westbecker entered the Standard Gravure printing plant with an AK-47 assault rifle, other weapons, and more than 1,000 rounds of ammunition. He killed 8 former co-workers and wounded 12 others before killing himself. For National Public Radio, I'm Brian Corin in Louisville.
Fired Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders is standing by her statement that masturbation should be discussed in sex education classes. Speaking on NBC's Today Show, Elders said she was surprised the comment cost her job, but added she was not angry at President Clinton. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 27.26 to close at 3718.37. This is NPR News. Senators Frank Murkowski and Paul Simon say they believe the new Congress will support the U.S.-North Korea nuclear accord. Speaking in Seoul today, the two said lawmakers will examine the agreement but probably won't make major changes. The senators met over the weekend with North Korean officials, although not with the new president, Kim Jong-il. Murkowski and Simon said the North Koreans want better relations with the U.S. Simon said he told them improved ties with South Korea had to be a part of that. Japan's trade minister says his country and the U.S. have settled a dispute over the Japanese flat glass market. At a news conference in Tokyo, the minister said the agreement will open up Japan's $4.5 billion market for flat glass. He said no date's been set for resuming stalled talks with the U.S. on the automotive trade. The military has increased security at camps for Cuban refugees in Panama, adding 3,000 American soldiers. Tomas Cabal reports from Panama City.
Two battalions of U.S. infantry soldiers will be flown in by the United States Southern Command to augment the existing security forces in the wake of violent protests that took place last week. This force will have to keep things under control in the four camps that house 8,500 Cuban rafters. According to Captain John Leggett, spokesman for Southern Command, the security forces will be equipped with shotguns and automatic weapons and will be authorized to use whatever force is necessary to maintain order. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Cabal in Panama City.
IBM has stopped shipments of PCs based on the Intel Corporation's Pentium chip. IBM officials say the chip is more flawed than they originally thought. In a statement, the company says no one should have to worry about the integrity of data calculated on IBM PCs. The cost of a first-class stamp will go up on New Year's Day to 32 cents. The Postal Service Governing Board voted today on the new rates. It's the first increase in 4 years. Officials say the average American household will spend about 45 cents more on stamps per week. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with forensic psychiatrist Dr. Park Dietz. He's testified in the trials of Jeffrey Dahmer, John Hinckley, and Joel Rifkin. He's the forensic psychiatrist for the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime. And he's also consulted to the CIA. His company, Threat Assessment Group, advises corporations on how to deal with dangerous employees and consumers. Dr. Dietz has said his calling is to study the strangest of crimes. Is there a difference between a perversion and a pathology?
Well, perversion is a kind of pathology. Some people who are critical of psychiatry would say that psychiatry shouldn't even deal with the issue of perversion, that it's all moral. I think they're wrong. I think that perversion is a mental disorder. And when I say perversion, I'm referring to what we technically call paraphilias, meaning an unusual activity that causes arousal. And this does not refer to whether people are straight or gay. It refers to an interest in children or in pain or in other things that are socially unacceptable. And the evidence seems stronger and stronger all the time that perversions are learned. There may be some individual differences in who's vulnerable to learning it that accounts for why some people become perverted and others don't. But it's unquestionable now that what it is that turns someone on is learned.
So in other words, you think that somebody can learn to have an association between sex and violence?
Absolutely. In the same way that men become leg men or breast men or these other kinds of stereotypes, there are people who become pain men. Women acquire these desires considerably less often by all accounts. And there's some thinking behind why that may be, but what's clear is that men are far more likely to become perverted and to commit crimes in the service of their perversions. But to be a sex criminal out of perversion, one has to be more than perverted. The chilling thing is to recognize that there are very large numbers of people, no one knows how large, who have these perversions and never act on them in any criminal manner. They find some lawful adaptation, a partner who is agreeable to engaging in the acts, fantasy. If they're willing to go a little outside the law, they'll find paid partners or use pornography or go to specialized clubs that will deliver these services. But if there's going to be a crime, if they're going to hurt people to fulfill themselves, there always has to be a second problem beside the perversion. Most often, that's an antisocial character, is the second problem. Sometimes it's alcoholism, as in the case of Dahmer. That's his second problem. Sometimes it's other kinds of character problems, and quite rarely it's a coincidental mental illness. Once every year or so, we'll have a case come through the office where someone who was perverse and never acted on it for many years acts on it when they get psychotically depressed, or when they have their first schizophrenic break.
You're telling us that you think the connection between, for instance, sex and violence can be learned. Are you concerned about sex and violence in the movies and on television?
I've been concerned about that for a long time. When I was on the Attorney General's Commission on Pornography, one of my principal themes was that whatever else came out of the commission's work, the most important thing that could be done immediately and voluntarily by the media was for the directors of Hollywood films to put a moratorium on the sex violence connectedness by putting in a 5-minute cooling off period between the scenes that would give males erections and the scenes in which women were mutilated. Just 5 minutes separation between erection and female mutilation would be a great public service. But ever since Hitchcock's Psycho, the formula of all these directors has been to mingle male arousal with female harm. And in doing that, they're training their young audience members to wish for that throughout life.
What reaction did you get on the Mies Commission when you suggested that?
Well, the commissioners all agreed with me about this, and it's and in fact, the commissioners all felt that sexual violence was the fundamental problem, and non-sexual violence was next. But the ACLU and the people controlling the pornography media spent so much money trying to convince the public that we were out there to ban Playboy that the public never heard the message.
Are there certain movies that you have found in your interviews with criminals inspired copycat crimes?
Oh, yeah. But not everything does this. Some crimes are susceptible to being copycatted, others aren't. I'm particularly interested in criminal innovations and how they're disseminated. And I've tracked the dissemination of some innovations and can say with great certainty that the entire product tampering phenomenon was invented through the media, disseminated through the media, and brought to us by the media. That one didn't even start with a real crime. It started with a piece of fiction. The same thing is true of other criminal innovations. Carjacking became a national phenomenon through the news.
You mean it was done on a very small scale, reported a lot, and then spread?
Sure. And you can even look, you can even see a peak in the graph following the most publicized incident when a woman in Maryland was dragged during a carjacking. That got a lot of front page press, and there was an immediate rise in carjackings all over the country.
Do you think the media shouldn't report stuff like that? Or?
Well, I think they shouldn't make it headline news nationally. If they want to increase the crime rate in their city for a week, that's all right, perhaps, but why should they bring it to everybody? Drive-by shootings, Hollywood and news media phenomenon. They started with a few shootings in L.A. Now you can be in a quiet town in the middle of America and have drive-by shooting thanks to the media.
Now, are there particular movies that you think have become classics in the sense that they've inspired a lot of people to...
Well, the obvious ones have been known for a long time, but nobody cares. Every time someone shows a rerun of The Deer Hunter on television, some kid's going to die of Russian roulette. That's been going on for 10 or 15 years now, and they still show it. Kids still die.
My guest is forensic psychiatrist Dr. Park Dietz. He's worked on the cases of Jeffrey Dahmer, John Hinckley, Joel Rifkin. He's consulted with the FBI, the CIA, and many businesses. He's also a consultant to the HBO program 9 to 5 about murder in the workplace. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is forensic psychiatrist Dr. Park Dietz. You know, I'm curious to hear your impressions of this, especially since you studied John Hinckley. I consider Taxi Driver to be one of the really great American films, and the fact that it inspired John Hinckley to do something absolutely tragic, I personally think can't be held against the movie, and I think the movie was just a brilliant study of an antisocial, probably psychopathic personality, a study of the kind of personality who you study. But this was a study of that personality through fiction. And I wonder what you think.
I don't disagree with you, but I have the advantage of knowing that it didn't inspire Hinckley. Uh-huh. It was a film he liked because he thought Jodie looked sexy in it. He had gotten interested in Jodie Foster from another film. It was The Little Girl Who Lived Down the Lane that really caught his eye, where she plays a somewhat provocative prepubescent child, not unlike the role played in The Professional that's currently showing, which I'm sure is going to cause a lot of controversy for the same reason that The Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane should have. Hinckley was interested in this prepubescent, juvenile, sexy girl, and she blossomed in Taxi Driver, and that's why he went back seeing it all those times. He did see Travis Bickle as something of a hero. In the same way I see Harrison Ford in Patriot Games as a hero, Hinckley identified with that character, wanted to be like him. But that's not inspiration. And his was not a copycat crime with respect to that film. It was a copycat crime with respect to the prior assassins that Hinckley had studied.
Who did he study?
He wrote a college term paper on Oswald. He read Arthur Bremer's diary. And that puts him right in the chain of assassins who are building on the careers of their forerunners. And then, of course, while he was stalking President-elect Reagan outside Blair House, he learned of John Lennon's murder and became immediately interested in Chapman, said, "There's a guy just like me." And he dropped everything and went to New York to attend the vigil outside the Dakota. And then he bought himself a copy of Catcher in the Rye. Years later, Robert Bardo, interested in an actress named Rebecca Schaefer and another named Tiffany, put together a assassin's kit, including his weapon and his copy of Catcher in the Rye. He read up on stalkers and assassins. He had a whole file on me when I examined him.
Was that frightening to you?
Well, it's of some concern. If the offenders are going to read what I say in the press, and they do, some of them let us know, and if they're going to learn from the technical things we write, that's a problem. And I've been self-censoring for some time. There's a lot of my most important work I can't publish because I know the offenders will read it. Ted Bundy was reading my articles on sexually sadistic criminals.
So you're afraid to say certain things because you think criminals will read it and be inspired by it?
Well, I'm not afraid. I just won't do it. It would be immoral of me to publish things that will help criminals do a more effective job. So I have to find different ways to disseminate the technology to law enforcement and to corporations who are trying to prevent crime.
Do you ever feel that you yourself are drawn to perversions just by virtue of your investigating them? I don't mean that you're perverse, but that you have you have this real interest in people who are.
Well, how else is one going to understand it? You know, I find my work fascinating. I get to meet everybody from hookers on the streets of New York to people in the White House and heads of state. And I don't see any risk of our fully understanding all of these behaviors in my lifetime, so I don't think I'm going to run out of things to look at. But it's not attractive.
Uh-huh.
Understanding it is attractive. Preventing it is what could be more important.
Since you see a much bigger proportion of criminals than most of us will thankfully ever see, when you meet a stranger, is there always a part of you in the back of your mind that's thinking, are they going to have on their fatigues and be toting around a rifle tomorrow? Are they going to blow?
Most people wear their deviance on their shirt sleeves. And if one knows how to read the behavior, it's not a big mystery.
Are there certain things you look for, or are there just things that are obvious?
Well, there are things that are obvious to me and that are perhaps not obvious to other people. And there's some rules of life that I advise that that are obvious to me and perhaps not to others. For example, when I point out to audiences that, of course, prudent people will lock their doors and make sure they have pins installed in sliding glass windows, they'll nod their heads and they'll understand that. But when I say you don't park next to vans, I see bewildered looks. Apparently, public hasn't recognized yet how often Fans without windows are used in crimes, both to abduct people and to conceal activity inside. So I would have thought by now it was obvious to everyone that you don't park next to vans.
I believe you started off thinking, you started off your college years thinking that you'd become a medical doctor, kind of following in your father's footsteps. What led you in this direction?
Well, it was a way to combine medicine and my medical education with something that seemed to me much needed and fascinating. The idea of forensic medicine, physicians helping solve crimes and helping to investigate and determine what was going on, struck me from the beginning as an ideal way to spend one's time. Then I realized that in psychiatry there was so much to learn that it seemed like there'd be no risk of running out of things to do, and that's proved true.
Do you ever have nightmares?
You know, I stopped remembering my dreams a long time ago. I don't remember them much. And
maybe there's a reason for that.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
What, was there a point when you stopped remembering? Had you had a lot before you stopped remembering them?
Well, you know, one can make oneself recall dreams better. I took a sleep and dreams course at Cornell where I kept a log, and boy, did I have a lot of dreams then. It works very well. But No, it wouldn't surprise me if they don't surface in part because I deal with such awful material. I'm aware of the work I do having some effect, and I have to struggle to keep a balance with it and to look at other parts of life and to find the nice things about people and humanity.
Dr. Dietz, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Park Dietz is the forensic psychiatrist for the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime. His company, Threat Assessment Group, is based in Newport Beach, California. You can see him on the new HBO documentary, Murder 9-5, about murder in the workplace. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have news today of the latest bombing attributed to Unabomb, the serial bomber who seems to be attacking at people in some way involved with computers. Also news of President Clinton as he sits with his advisors and begins to figure out whether he can offer a middle-class tax cut, what kind of a tax cut, and how he might pay for it. And Susan Stamberg will have a report on the exhibit Free Within Ourselves, an exhibit about art by African-American artists and how they had difficulty finding a place to exhibit.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. After all these years, Bob Dylan is still out on the road, singing many of his most familiar songs in unexpected arrangements. He's got a new TV special on MTV's Unplugged series, and he's just released a third volume of so-called greatest hits. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
The very title, Greatest Hits Volume 3, must be Bob Dylan's idea of a gruff joke. This 14-song collection gathers material from Dylan's past 20 years, and while some of them are very good, like the tune I just played, The Groom Still Waiting at the Altar, not a one of them was anything you or I would call a big hit, or even one of his greatest. I mean, were you yearning for a CD that would contain both Hurricane, his loopy hymn to boxer convict Hurricane Carter, and Gotta Serve Somebody, his fervent hymn to the most obsequious brand of Christianity? No, Greatest Hits Volume 3 is a typically willful, idiosyncratic gathering of Dylan's dross. But halfway through, he tucks in something else, a previously unreleased song called Dignity.
Fat man looking in a blade of steel. looking at his last meal. Taliban looking in a cotton field for dignity. A wise man looking in a blade of grass. Young man looking in the shadows that pass. Poor man looking through painted glass for dignity. Somebody got murdered on New Year's Eve. Somebody said dignity was the first to leave. I went into the city, went into the town, went into the land of the midnight sun.
With its rockin' laundry list of mismatched images organized around a haphazard search for dignity, this song may remind you of Subterranean Homesick Blues or any number of other good Dylan songs. But it has a fresh kick and humor that's been missing from a lot of his recent work. Dylan loves to take abstract principles, love, faith, dread, or in this case, dignity, and gnaw at them like bones, scraping away layers of cliché to get at some sort of essential marrow.
Drinking man listening to the voice he hears. In a crowded room full of covered up mirrors. Looking into the lost, forgotten years for dignity. Met Prince Philip at the home of the blues. Said he gave me information if his name wasn't used. He wanted money up front. Said he was abused by dignity.
You can catch Dylan doing a terrific version of this song on MTV's Unplugged this month. Fronting a tight five-piece band with his usual stoic deadpan, Dylan rolls out The Times They Are A-Changin' and All Along the Watchtower as if he can't believe the cheering audience actually wants to hear them. But when he does Dignity, he bears down hard and enunciates clearly. He wants you to hear his allusion to Rambeau when he talks about standing in a drunken boat, and to follow him when he describes a sick man combing his hair and realizing his future looks thin. Dignity won't be a hit either, but who cares? Dylan should have called this album One Good Song and Some Stuff You Might Like.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Bob Dylan's Greatest Hits, Volume 3. Dylan performs on MTV's Unplugged, December 14th and 18th.
So many roads, so much at stake. Too many dead ends. I'm at the edge of the lake. Sometimes I wonder what it's gonna take to find dignity.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Cherie Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet country singer and yodeler Don Walter. It's taken 40 years, but he's finally left his day job. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
I'm just a cowboy from Dallas to